Wonderful. For those of you who couldn't get to the questions, Dr. Silicano will be here after Dr. Cheever's talk. And I flipped the order of the speakers. I apologize for that, but I think it is kind of good to have Dr. Cheever speak to us as we go into our lunch break because it'll give us time to talk about that over lunch. But Dr. Cheever, everyone knows, is the Associate Administrator of the HIV/AIDS Bureau at HRSA. And she, what makes her so effective is not only she's just a great person, great administrator, but she still sees patients. So she sees what we see. And therefore, when we talk to her, ask for help in addressing problems, she gets it. And so today she's going to give us an update on where we are with the Ryan White program.
Yeah. Hi, good afternoon. So I was trying to figure out, of all the different kind of policy work we do and the work we do across the Bureau, what would be the most important things for you all to know. And I think hopefully I've hit on some of these that will give you some food for thought or things that you need to be working on in your community. I have no financial conflicts. I work for the government. I receive a salary from them. Our vision of the Bureau is optimal HIV care and treatment for all, and our mission is to provide both leadership and resources to assure access to and retention in high-quality integrated care and treatment services for vulnerable people living with HIV and their families. Our entire program is really based on the back of the Ryan White statute. So a lot of the things that you do that make you crazy, you do because it's based on the law. At some point, that law will be reauthorized, and that would be a time for you all to give good input to people that are reauthorizing the law to make it work better for you. Within our Bureau, we've had a similar priorities over the last several years, and that's to achieve the goals of the National HIV/AIDS Strategy and PEPFAR. We have a global portfolio. To build leadership, both within the Bureau, we provide some leadership around HIV care and treatment for the U.S. government, but also locally for people living with HIV, for other state and local public health leaders. Enhancing partnerships is critical. We are not going to end the HIV epidemic in the United States on the solely with the Ryan White program. It really is about making sure we're leveraging all the funding that is coming in to your single state authorities for substance abuse treatment. There is millions and millions of dollars going in across the states. How do we leverage that in the context of the program, as well as with for housing opportunities, for prevention? There are other federal state funds that we need to be linking with more effectively. We're supporting integration, both in terms of HIV prevention and care, since that really is one seamless thing. I think everyone understands that clearly now, as well as around substance abuse treatment and mental health therapies. How do we really assure patient-centered care in terms of getting some of those special services in? And finally, we do need to use our data in order to drive improvements and use our data more effectively. So we are doing quite a bit within the Bureau to increase the transparency of our data. We're trying to get our data so that we could have some risk adjustment and be able to publish our data at a provider level so that people could see how different providers in different areas are doing, and we're getting input on that. So around the conference, if you're staying for the conference, and we'll have other opportunities to get your input about really looking at outcomes at the level of the individual clinic. So we have made great progress across the country. These are data from the Ryan White program. We define viral suppression for anyone that comes into the clinic at least once in that year. So the person's had some connection with medical care. What proportion are virally suppressed at the end of the year or at the last visit they have? And you can see that in 2010, that was 69.5% in Ryan White programs. It is up to 85% in 2016, and the 2017 data will be released in just a couple of days. So you can see that in every state, we have made significant improvements. Some states we've improved much more than others, and we continue to have significant disparities. So I think we all are in agreement here that we have the tools to end the epidemic in this country, and we have some places that are making much more progress than others. So one of the themes you'll be hearing about as I'm talking is really how do we figure out what those evidence-informed practices are. Many of the improvements people are making are not being done in complex NIH randomized trials with three PhDs and 10 assistants in the intervention, but are really being done by you all looking at your quality data and making improvements. So how do we better collect that information and make it available for you? And we have several projects where we're trying to do that, and you'll be hearing more about that if you stay for the rest of the meeting. So the National HIV/AIDS Strategy actually does really drive a lot of our work, and we are updating both the National HIV/AIDS Strategy and the National Virus Hepatitis Action Plan, and there's a listening session on Tuesday night. For those of you who are here, I would encourage you to attend that. We'll have people from the Department of Health and Human Services, from the Office of HIV and Infectious Disease Policy, OHADIP, here to be getting input from all of you. And if you're not here, whoever from your clinics are here, please encourage some of them to attend. So today I really want to focus on three areas, the 2019 budget, some Ryan White policy changes, and some of the clinical activities we're doing. So first, amazingly, for the first time in my 19 years in federal service, we had a full appropriation for HHS on October 1st. So that was very exciting. Great job, Congress. We are just now starting to get all of our money because I don't think anyone knew what to do about that anymore. It just took a little time. But we are trying to get out full awards for the Part C grants in January. We are trying to get out full awards for the Part A program. So we are really excited to be doing that because I know that when some of you, especially the January 1st Part Cs, you get these three little pittances of money over the course of the year and you're trying to figure out what to do. We'll actually hopefully be able to get you your full award. We're working on that right now. But you can also see here that of the money, $1.3 billion goes to Part B, and $900 million of that goes to the AIDS Drug Assistance Program. So most of this money goes to fund drugs. And fascinatingly, that in our program, over half of all people in the United States that are on antiretroviral treatment are getting support from the AIDS Drug Assistance Program, whether it's through purchasing insurance for low-income people that don't have insurance or helping with the marketplace or doing copays or deductibles for people that are insured. If most states, their ADAP program helps provide services to people under like 400 or 500% of federal poverty, so those people are, even though they have some funds, are still really not able to afford their copays and deductibles. This program helps fill the gaps. So it's a remarkable part of the program, but it is much of the $2.3 billion. After that, it's the dark green is the Part A program, which is funding to cities that account for over more than 70% of all the people with HIV in the United States. And you can see a much smaller proportion for Part C. Part D I'm going to discuss in a little bit more detail, and that is 3%. That's the dark blue. I have a pointer that works, apparently, I was told. Yes, so the Part D is 3% of the Ryan White dollars, but an important 3% given some of the disparities that persist. Another way of looking at our appropriation is our change in appropriation over time. And once again, you can see that the largest amount of money is going to the ADAP, followed by Part A and Part B base. An important thing to notice on the Part B base is that for states that don't have a city, this is all the money they get, which is a relatively small proportion of money to do all the medical case management and medical care and everything outside of treatment. This is their really only pocket other than the Part Cs and some Ds that provide medical care. But the other important thing to notice about this is that really our funding has been fairly flat, or as we say in the federal government, maintained, which is a success, but maintained in the last few years. And obviously everything is getting a little bit more expensive. Salaries are getting more expensive. Medical care gets more expensive. So people continue to figure out how to maneuver their systems to continue to take care of the same amount of people. And I think we're all challenged by the fact that it's estimated that about 400,000 people are out of care in this country. So as we have these great improvements in our viral suppression among those in care, the next great challenge for our program is all those people that are out of care. How do we work differently within our systems of care to bring those people into care? And if we do, you know, how do we care for them and fund it, given the flat funding? The good news we have here is that we have, in the last few years, we've had a lot of people doing very well with a 340B program and generating some program income off of 340B. So that is how some people are solving that. Moving now to the policy clarification notices. So we put out policy clarification notices, which is our attempt to take our legislation and explain how programs should be implemented in a way that's going to work for a lot of people around passing their audits that they have. We've looked to update our clarification notices really based on questions and comments we get from you all and to reduce administrative burden. So I'm going to discuss four, two that we revised and two that are new that I think are relevant for you all. First, in terms of clinical quality management, it's in our statute that we have to have clinical quality management programs, and we have them for all service categories, which for some people was incredibly complicated. They say, why do we need this outside of clinical care? Well, I would say if we're funding transportation and it sucks, we should fix it. So that's, you need to know how well your transportation system, for example, is working. But we have changed it to say that if less than 15% of your clients are using that service that you're funding, you do not need to have a service, you do not need to have a quality measure. And if you have between 15 and 50% of your clients are using that service, you only need to have one measure. For any, for any service categories where more than 50% of your clients are getting that service, you need to have two different measures. And we can help you figure out what those measures should look like if you can't figure out what it might look like for transportation service, for example. The second one is 1602, which is just where we list all of the eligible services, and we really just helped refine the definitions. I think the most important thing for you all is that we have been explicit that you can use telehealth as a modality in HIV, in Ryan White. You can fund it however you want to fund it. Once again, it's payer of last resort, so if your Medicaid is funding telehealth and there's a Medicaid patient, you need to use Medicaid first. But if you need to do telehealth and they don't have access in the context of Medicaid, then you can use your Ryan White funds for that. People had always asked us that, and we said we've never prohibited it, so sure, you can do it, but now we've made it more explicit. The two new policy clarification notices we have, one is 1801, which is really about using Ryan White services for buying health care coverage premiums, so insurance premiums and cost sharing assistance. Here we had three different PCNs out that all said similar things, and we combined them all into one so it was easier to read. We were more explicit about Medicare, given that over half of our patients are over 50 now, that you can use Ryan White funds to help cover Part B, C, and D, and it lays out how you would do that. Part A is for inpatient services, and Ryan White is an outpatient disease, so for explicitly funding inpatient services, we couldn't get there. But you can for the other parts of Medicare, and you should read it to get the details on that. The other part is PCN 1802, which is about incarcerated patients. And this was something that we had not really looked at. Our previous policy was from 2007. The short version of what we say there is that for patients that are in state prisons and in federal prisons, that if transition services aren't funded in those settings, you can use Ryan White's funds to fund transition services. Some ADEPs, for example, have done great jobs where people, when they're leaving prisons, are sort of applying for ADEP as they walk out the door and are able to access their medications seamlessly. That would be an example. For people that are in jails, local jails, our payer of last resort doesn't apply to jails. We don't like to say that out loud very much, but this is a good time to mention that. So payer of last resort is really about state and federal funding. So for jails, if healthcare coverage is not adequate in jail, if there are pieces missing from jail, you can use Ryan White funds to cover patients in jail. We'd prefer that the local jails pay, but if they're not, that people should not go off their medications, and it's outlined in that PCN. Viral suppression. We've talked about U equals U in the federal government. We were a little nervous about U equals U as being a little simplistic for a lot of the reasons that I think I've heard people discussing in sidebars. Several large studies obviously demonstrate that people that are undetectable are unlikely to transmit HIV sexually, and so the federal government speak now is we have effectively no risk of sexual transmission, and I think Mike Sagg had brought that up in his earlier talk. But we do think that it is important that we share messaging about viral suppression for people, and the community has been very clear that for some people it really makes a difference about how they feel about themselves. A friend of mine was saying that for her it's not been about the sex, it's been about talking to her son about, I have this infectious disease, this and that. She's like, well, I have a disease, but it's not infectious, so I can stop saying that. So it's just sort of thinking about even how people feel about themselves. In the context of the Ryan White program, though, you have data on your patient. So when you're talking to someone, I'm talking to someone about their viral suppression and whether they're infectious. I'm like, you know, if you were to stay on your medicines and you didn't have a drug interruption every time you need to get a refill, like if you could just, we could plan differently and work differently on that, because every time you need a refill, you're off your medicine for 2 weeks and you have this you have a detectable viral load. So, you know, you can use it in that context, as well as tailored messaging around sexual health and sexual health practices. So I have I have never seen so much syphilis in my life as I've seen in the last year. And I was in Baltimore in the 90s when we were having our crack epidemic. So it's really incredible the amount of syphilis I'm seeing. So, you know, having that discussion in the context of this person's real experience with STIs as well. So it's not just about U equals U, but it's around their sexual health written more broadly. And you can have those, I think those are two sort of different nuanced discussions that you can have. And we sent out a letter to all of you encouraging you to make sure we do have that ongoing discussion, that staff is using some of the same vocabulary across the program, because patients had been reporting they were getting a really different message from the nurse, from the doctor, from the prevention provider, and it should be fairly seamless in terms of what you're saying. Next, we're switching to the Part D program. As I said, it's a small part of our program, 3% of our funding. But you can see here, when we look at viral suppression, the first darker bar is all the people in the program. It's about 85%. Women are at 84%, so similar, but a teeny disparity. Youth have a bigger disparity, 71% viral suppression. And children and infants have a viral suppression rate that's almost 85% the national average. So you can see that we do still have disparities, particularly around youth. So when we look then at our where our populations are getting care, oh, I have the pointer. I love having a pointer. Okay, so you can see that for children and youth, about 65% of them are getting care at a center that's getting funded by multiple parts. They're getting part A, B, C, D, some combination of funding between those different parts. But you can see that 20% of them are getting care in a program that's only getting Part D funding. So clearly Part D, 1 in 5 children are really dependent on Part D for some of the care they're getting in the context of Ryan White. When we look at youth, it's significantly less than that, about 4%. And we look at women, it's even smaller, it's about 1%. So the role of Part D, just pure Part D funding, is very important, but particularly for children. But when we look across all the parts, the question is, how could we leverage the Part D funding differently? I'm not saying we're going to defund everyone, but how can we think about it, the Part D program, a little differently so that we make sure we have bigger impact? It's 3% of our funds. Currently, it's 115 recipients, so it's in just certain areas around the country with Part D funding. How should we be thinking about the funding differently? And so we're thinking about that, and we are going to have a listening session on Tuesday from 5 to 6:15. You might notice that Tuesday is a popular night all of a sudden. So the National HIV AIDS Strategy Session and this listening session are happening at the same time. But if you have some ideas about how we could be using either some part or all of the Part D program funding, and we're actually not talking about all the Part D funding program, where I think we're continuing the program we have, but how could we use some of the funding differently to achieve some different outcomes, particularly around youth? Okay, finally, in terms of clinical activities, I'm just going to go over this very quickly. Retention measure, the current one we have, you have to be seen twice in a year, 3 months apart. How could we look at that differently? Because it doesn't really work. It's not consistent with clinical practice. Could it be you see a doctor or clinician once, and then 4 months later you have a viral load, and that would be virally suppressed? We're going to talk about that on Monday at 5:45, so I'd encourage you to attend. It'll be a good session. Other activities, hepatitis C elimination. We are really interested in eliminating hepatitis C. Dave Thomas is going to be talking about that. We've funded 2 different initiatives on that, and I think one thing we've learned is that we in the Ryan White program need to better support some hepatitis C surveillance so we can understand exactly who every co-infected person is and go and treat them. The plenary on Wednesday, someone from Hartford, Connecticut, is going to talk about how they actually have done that. STIs are a huge issue, as I've already mentioned, and we have funded, we're funding a SPINS initiative around trying to improve STI transmission interruption, particularly around doing screening differently. How can you have an easier way of doing a multi-site screening, for example, other than if a clinician if you take it away from the clinician, often you can get it done better. So different people use different strategies, and we're going to be testing that. The HIV curriculum, I think I already had David talk about this. This is an incredible resource with incredible graphics. Great if you have a training program, if you're tracking competencies of clinicians. It really does a tremendous amount of things, and I'd encourage you to look at it. And then focus on special populations. So when we see disparities that we have in our data, what we've really done is try to, as I said earlier, try to disseminate, try to understand what those best practices are and then disseminate them widely. So we have several activities where we've been doing that. These will all be at the meeting here in the coming week. So if you're going to be here, I'd encourage you. We have SPINs where we've taken our jail initiative, our buprenorphine initiative, an outreach initiative, and an engagement and retention initiative, and we've tried to box them so you can sort of take it off the shelf, and you'll hear progress we've made with that. We've also done something where we've tried to quickly get experts to tell us what they think are the best interventions nationally that we should be replicating, and we're doing that in four areas around Black MSM, transgender women, behavioral health, particularly buprenorphine again, and for people, particularly women with a history of trauma, and what we can be doing in clinics to improve outcomes among those populations. And then I'll end on the building futures. This is a really interesting, I would encourage you to look at this, go to their website, you can get it at the Target Center. We went to youth programs where they actually have really good outcomes for youth, and we looked what they were doing, and then we went to programs that were having pretty bad outcomes for youth, and we looked what they were doing, and we tried to assess what were those best practices from the places where they were getting it to work, and have those in a toolkit that I think is very accessible for you that want to improve your outcomes with youth. So my time is up. So with that, I'm going to end. I'll be here all week and open for questions.
We have time for a couple questions, if you'd like. While we're waiting, one of the somebody came up to me at the break and was talking about a patient who needed hip surgery, and the surgeon was arguing that it's not safe to do, et cetera. The resources for that is a guy named Bill Schechter, who is at UCSF, and you go to the HIV Insight website, and there's articles galore on the safety of that. So just wanted to give follow-up there. Yes, please.
Yes, I just wanted to ask a question about transgender persons who are living with HIV. Would there ever be an opportunity for Ryan White funds to be used for hormone therapy?
Yes, so in the context of Ryan White, we talk about all the primary care needs of the patient that we can relate to their HIV. So different programs do that differently, but there are certainly programs that have funded that as sort of a patient-centered approach to care. And I think there are some best practices when you look across the country that to really engage transgender women in care, you need to meet them with where they are in terms of what their greatest needs are in meeting those needs.
Would Ryan White pay for PrEP services?
That is a great question. I didn't cover that. So our legislation, we can only provide clinical services to people that are HIV infected. So with the current legislation, we cannot provide PrEP in the context of Ryan White. We've strongly encouraged our Ryan White providers that want to provide PrEP to figure out, if they can find other sources for PrEP, they can use the Ryan White infrastructure. Some places have used the ADAP infrastructure so that if they have state funds that they're going to somehow fund PrEP, they do it on the back of the infrastructure of the ADAP program, but the ADAP program is not paying for it. If, once again, as we come up to the National HIV AIDS strategy, as we come up to reauthorization, you should make sure your voice is heard as you think that's something that should be funded in the context of Ryan White. Right now, you cannot fund clinical care.
So with regard to Medicare cost-sharing support, what about Part C, Medicare Part C, the Advantage program? Since they include an inpatient component, can we still support those?
Yeah, so you can do C, D, B, C, and D can be supported. Just like the ADAPs buy insurance for people. Like many ADAPs, their primary function right now is they purchase insurance, which covers everything. You've got to prove that it's cost effective, and you can buy it. But why we can't fund Part A is because that's really inpatient only, and that's not consistent with a broader insurance coverage.
So, Ms. Cheever, Dr. Rosado from Salt Lake City, Utah University Hospital. So there is a lot of new initiative that we should be implemented, the opioid crisis and other stuff. In my particular case, Part C, last year or this year, 2018, they took away $26,000 from our grant in Utah. It's the only, you know, Ryan White program in the whole state. And I see that there is new initiative, new thing to do. And so I am confused about the government want us to do more, and at the same time they're taking money away from the grant, again, my case. So I found that very interesting and upsetting that at the same time you need to do more with less money. In the last 2 or 3 years, actually, we had about 200 new cases. About 70% of those new cases belong to Part C, and about 50% of those cases are going to go to Part C because they don't have any other medical insurance. And then at the same time, we are getting less money. So I don't know if other places have talked to you about this.
Yeah, thanks. So that is really hard. So just to take a minute to talk about Part C. So in the Part C program, when we recompeted it last year for the first time, we had actually adjusted the program. So rather than getting however much money you got when you were started 10 years ago, you were going to get money based on the number of clients you were seeing, as well as some other factors, including the number of people that were uninsured and some of the high-risk populations that you might be taking care of. So the Part C program across the country, we use this new funding methodology. We did put in guardrails so that no one got more than a 10% decrease in their Part C and no one got more than a 25% increase, because we thought people that would get big increases, you know, they could spend more time kind of a little bit, we'd slow down how quickly they got their increases so we could reduce the amount of decreases people were getting. So I think it sounds like you might have been part of that where you had some decreases on the number of cases. And so that really is about us trying to get more parts for the programs that have really doubled or tripled in size, getting them more funding. And it is really tough, and I don't have a good answer for that. In the next recompetition, if you've had a lot more cases, then you'll be relatively, we're going to reset. After the 3 years, we'll reset in the next competition of the Part C.
Okay. Got three quick questions to wrap up. So could you clarify, patients sometimes get confused about viral suppression and being undetectable, and can you clarify what you mean by that?
Yes. So the U equals U movement is undetectable. It means is untransmittable. In the context of the Ryan White program, we usually talk about a CD4, a viral load of less than 200 as being virally suppressed, but they're not necessarily undetectable because we can detect them. So I think that's sort of a nuance in terms of how, when I'm talking to patients, I talk about being virally suppressed, which for the reasons I think that you talked about or someone had talked about this morning, is less than 200 versus being undetectable, and it really depends what your level of detection is. In some programs, it's going down even less than 20. So more and more people will be detectable while we might still consider them suppressed. So we have that kind of nuanced discussion.
Okay, and then two quick. One is that kind of a question, I think it relates mostly to 340B versus regular programs, but let's say the question's about eye exams and eyeglasses and what can the Ryan White program, and I assume by extension 340B, I think they go under the same rules, what can they pay for in that regard?
Yeah, so just to clarify, so 340B can pay for any cost that's allowable in the context of the Ryan White program. So if it's allowable in Ryan White, 340, you can pay for it, and you could use it to pay administrative expenses and blow out the 10% cap. You don't have the core medical services, 75, 25. But it does have to be for an allowable cost. So it's really up to you all to figure out what's allowable related to HIV. So I think certainly most programs in the past have covered eye exams if they can afford to cover eye exams. And where people draw the line around eyeglasses and other things really is something people determine at the local level.
And finally, I think this is more of a history lesson. You don't have to go into great detail, but the question's about, I live in a rural area. We have problems, too. How come all the Part A money goes to the cities?
Yeah, so that's great. And so if you're staying for the conference, they're going to have like a little video that'll run through the history of the program. But the program was really started based on the Ryan White program in general. the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation had funded a number of sort of pilots, including funding big cities that were being really where the HIV was first most pronounced and being decimated. So that's why the funding went there. If you do, you can, Carl Schmidt is going to be presenting at the meeting as well about looking at the relative amount different places get depending on whether they have big city or not in their state versus if they don't. We have a funding formula in law that tries to correct that a little bit in terms of how much the states get. The states get a little less if they have a city that's also being funded. But you're right. The way the law was written, we fund mayors, we fund governors, and we fund directly community-based organizations, which politically has worked out really well in a lot of ways, but might be some consideration for all of you as you think about reauthorization.
Great. Thank you very much. Great job. And thanks to all of our speakers today, not only for their content and their question and answers, but also for staying on time. We have an hour, 25 minutes for lunch, wherever you can find it. I suggest under the Ferris wheel. And we'll be back here at 1:55 with Dr. Thompson and a review of recent data for meetings.